My name is Aurora Kolar. It is September 16th. We are in the beautiful city of Corpus Christi, Texas, and we're here with my interviewee, Mrs. Karen Howden, to talk a little bit about Old Bayview Cemetery. Ms. Howden, do I have permission to record you?
Absolutely, yes.
Alrighty, then we will start off with a few questions. Firstly, how did you find your passion for history and teaching?
Actually, my first teaching field was government. And when I got my job teaching eighth grade history, I was excited because I got to teach government with that. But it was being with eighth graders who, 13 years old, they've never really been taught history. They dressed up as pilgrims and such as that, but they were never taught why pilgrims came and the consequences of their coming. That was never they never made those connections. And so when I was able to teach with them or teach to them these consequences and reasons, then they were enthralled, and most of them, and I was enthralled. I really enjoyed sharing history.
Next question. All right, how did you come to be the vice president of Nueces County Historical Commission?
Well, actually, I was the vice president of the Nueces County Historical Society. The commission is the Nueces County Historical Commission is part of the Commissioner's Court in Nueces County, and it's they're appointed, and we appoint a chair and a co-chair, but I've never held those positions. I was the vice president of the Nueces County Historical Society. And just being involved with the society, the interest of history, and Anita Eisenhower, she was the one who suggested I run for vice president. And like most societies, there's usually no one running against you, so I became the vice president. My duties was basically to take over if the president couldn't be there. I know it's going to sound strange, but I'm very uncomfortable in front of a crowd, unless you're eighth graders. Then I can sing and dance, stand on my hand, whatever. But in a crowd, in front of my peers, I pretty well clam up. And sometimes I can, when I'm talking about Old Bayview Cemetery, my passion for protecting that outweighs my timid personality. So anyway, I never did become president. I told them I wasn't even interested in being president because I didn't want to have to sit, stand up and speak. And you can only serve for so many terms for us as in a particular position as officer. So I then became the hospitality chair. I bring the punch and the cookies.
An excellent job, to be sure. How did you first hear about Old Bayview Cemetery?
I don't remember the first time I heard about it. I don't remember. And it really wasn't anything that kind of stuck in my head. I may have read about it in a column in the paper or something like that, but to read it in the newspaper, you look at that and you say, oh, that's terrible. Someone needs to restore, someone needs to protect that. Whatever group is doing a good job now, they need to be commended or whatever. But it's too easy to just be dismissed from it just by reading an article. And that's the reason why we do the Voices of South Texas is to get people actually down there. And the first time I ever was in Old Bayview Cemetery is I was actually in there with eighth graders. We had gone on a field trip to the museum, and Flower Bluff ISD is a very large school, and we had almost 400 eighth graders trying to circulate into the museum and the Lexington and such. And we had about 30 minutes of just downtime. And the bus, I said something to the bus driver, and he was game, and he took us over there. He knew where it was at. And we walked through it. I remember that the grass was very high. I remember that, you know, the tree limbs were pretty shoddy, and the kids walked around there. I probably had maybe 60 kids out there. They walked around, and I didn't know anything about the people there at that time. This is probably, you know, 30 years ago, and 25 or 30 years ago. So I really couldn't share a whole lot with them. I knew that it was with Zachary Taylor's troops. I could tell them that. But I couldn't find those soldiers. First place, it was so overgrown. One thing I remember about that, though, is we looked at the headstone with the two sisters who had drowned in the off the island. And that marker was upright. Okay, it was standing up. And the kids were just fascinated by that because they never found the girls. And that marker, when I became involved with preserving Old Bayview Cemetery, that marker's down and it's in really bad shape. So that was something that I remembered just that short of time that marker had been either vandalized or erosion, you know, had caused it to fall over. I was just flabbergasted that marker was down.
How did you get involved with the upkeep of Old Baby Cemetery?
I'm part of the Nueces County Historical Commission. I'm on the Nueces County Historical Commission. And the last 3 years before I retired from Flower Bluff in 2009. And if you know anything about teachers in public school, they base your retirement on the last 3 years' salary. So I had spent pretty much the last 3 years going above and beyond with UIL, Student Council, just trying to get stipends up to get my salary up. So I wasn't that active with the commission from about 2006 to 2009. I'd check in on them occasionally. So that when I did retire and I came back, Anita Eisenhower handed me a pamphlet from a cemetery walk in Amarillo, Texas. And I looked at that, and the first they just clicked that this is what we are going to have to do. We can do this. It sounds like fun. I had just retired. I wanted to be in, you know, get kids involved and stuff. And I still had some connections with schools. And that's when I became really interested in preserving and restoring it. It's because I had told Miss Eisenhower at the time, you know, this is something we could do. You cannot get people interested in something just by putting a column in a paper or reading it in a book. Yeah, you're going to grab some of them. But you got to fire up a community. You got to show them what's there. And you have to make it real to them. So our very first cemetery walk took place in the spring of 2010. I had called up to Amarillo, cemetery up in Amarillo that was conducting that walk, and talked to them, and they told me about a gentleman in San Angelo at the Fort Concho that was doing a cemetery walk. So I called him, and I was really scared, you know, my gosh, you know, we're going to invite people out here, and I'm going to have to talk. And he said, just do it. He said, they will come, just do it. And we really hadn't decided on when was the best time to do this, but he had suggested doing it in spring, flowers are blooming, you know, that kind of thing. So our very first one was in the spring of 2010. And the people who came out, of course, the cemetery is in terrible shape. It's overgrown, limbs are down. Many, many headstones are down. And they, but every single one of those people that talked to us, and we had about 300 people show up. We're only out there 4 hours. So we had about 300 people just show up. We were amazed. Every single one that talked to us said, thank you for doing this. We've wanted to come out and see this cemetery, but we either didn't know where it was at, or, you know, we didn't know that much about it. And we were telling them about those folks that were there. We settled on our cemetery walk being in November in honor of Veterans Day, because it was started by the soldiers from the Mexican War. And from Zachary Taylor's troops, it was half the United States Army that was in Corpus Christi in the summer of 1845. It was about 4,000 troops that eventually showed up here. And they were listed as the Army of Observance, of Observation, Army of Observation, because it was no man's land. Mexico was claiming the Nueces as their northern boundary, and Texas was claiming the Rio Grande as the southern boundary. So it was this no man's land in between. And because we're south of the Nueces River, Corpus Christi was in that no man's land. So when the troops came here, it was to provoke. I mean, there was no other way to describe it. And they were here until March of 1846, when they go south, finally get Mexico to cross the Rio Grande so that they can have a battle, and voila, that's their excuse. Mexico invaded Texas. So now, and by March of 1846, Texas is a state, which kind of makes you wonder. When Zachary Taylor's troops were here in 1845, the summer of 1845, Texas is still Texas, a republic, and it was a foreign country. So you had half the United States Army in a foreign country preparing to invade another foreign country. Anyway, so, I mean, it wasn't, and I love saying that to my eighth graders, because they understood that, you know, people just don't go off to war. There's little shenanigans going on to try to provoke or there's an end goal. And, the war with Mexico went on for 2 years. The results is we get California, which has all this gold, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Texas. And I just can't imagine them going to war for the land between the Nueces and the Rio Grande. I just can't see that. I feel that it was more to get the Southwest. Gold's discovered in California in 1849. The war with Mexico's over in 1848. That gold did not just pop up out of the ground in 1849. It was there. They knew it was there. And people in California knew that they did not want that gold to go to Mexico, to the government in Mexico, because that's who would have picked it up. California did not want to be a slave state, And so they had to change the Missouri Compromise. They came up with the Compromise of 1850, which allowed for popular sovereignty, which starts this little miniature civil war in Kansas and Nebraska. And, you know, then we go on into civil war of trying to balance this legislature, and just didn't work. Just because Zachary Taylor's troops came to Corpus Christi. That's what's going to be the consequences. So it's they're really important to be there, and it's the staging area. What we have found is that when I spoke to the gentleman down in at the Palo Alto National Battlefield, my question to them was, where are those soldiers who were killed in the Battle of Palo Alto? Some of them were Zachary Taylor's troops. And he said that they were buried in Brownsville, but the Department of the Army disinterred them and moved them to New Orleans. Well, no one moved the soldiers at Old Bayview. They're still there. So as far as we know, Corpus Christi at Old Bayview Cemetery are the only location of soldiers who were part of Zachary Taylor's troops who died while they were soldiers in Zachary Taylor's troops. Now, we have veterans of Taylor's troops here who came back to Corpus Christi, lived, died, you know, worked, and they're buried over there. But I believe there's about 30, 40 of them at Old Bayview that died while they were the Army of Observation. They died of accidents, the Dayton explosion, rattlesnake bites, disease, you know, heart attack. Just they died of just various things when you put 4,000 troops together in 1845. So they're still there. Somewhere in Old Bayview, they're still there. Nowhere else in Texas, though. They're all dug up and sent back over to New Orleans. So when we started doing the cemetery walks, and we settled on November, trying to hit Veterans Day, we discovered that doing it in the spring, we also had the problem of our reenactors. They go and do Goliad and the Alamo and San Jacinto and such. So it was really putting a lot of pressure on them. So we invited the city council when we had our next cemetery walk, which was in November of 2010. And once again, we were out there and the grass was high, the limbs were down. People thanked us profusely about doing that. And we invited city council to come out there. And only one city council member came out, and she was just appalled. Well, we had already set up a work day for December, I think it was like December 5th or something, to go out there and clean up and trim limbs and such off the headstones and set it up with the city that we would go do that. And when we got out there, it was done. That city council member went back and said, "You're going to go over there and clean that up." So it was just great. It was wonderful. And they've done a really good job ever since. They've all, you know, I can call them and say, "Hey, this is grass is grown up over here, getting pretty high. Y'all need to do something about it." And it's on the circuit for downtown Corpus Christi and Cole Park and such. It's one of those, and they do a rotation. But if we have an event out there, a historical marker or whatever, and I call them, they'll come out there and do it. They'll you know, run the mowers over it. But as we just did these cemetery walks, and you just became curious. Back in 2000, there was a grant for a master plan for Old Bayview Cemetery, and part of that grant money went for a website that you can go to at the Corpus Christi Public Libraries. And several, Monsignor Howell, Rosa Gonzalez, Geraldine McGloin, and Herb Canales, they researched as many of those that are interred there and came up with this website. And with that, they had obituaries, plus some of them had family stories, letters, and such. So that's on that website. And as you just go to that website and you start looking and you think, wow, this is just amazing. These, you know, these people had a life. And they can just be random. I can, you know, some of them, there's not a whole lot to say about them. But one day I was just clicking around and came across Jessica Clark. And, you know, she was a young woman, and she, her and the other, her friends, while Corpus Christi was occupied during the Civil War by Union troops, they would pass messages to Confederate sympathizers about what these Union soldiers and officers were doing. They were probably about 16, 17 years old, these girls. So, I mean, that's kind of dangerous if you think about it. And but there was a lark, you know, they were 17, they were having a good time, young men, you know, it was great. And if you know about Reconstruction in the South, Corpus Christi was really hard hit. We had gone through a drought. Money wasn't any good. And here we are occupied by these soldiers. So anyway, that's as we started picking up on these stories and looking at these headstones and how vandals had been in there. And we probably don't have as much destruction from vandals as we do with erosion and mowers. You know, that's the mowers and they get in a big hurry. If they let the grass get too high up, they just mow over a headstone laying on the ground, and that tears them up too. So that's pretty much how I became involved in the upkeep and preservation, just because as we were trying to bring attention to it, we needed to, we wanted to fix some things up. Our preservation and upkeep, back in 2018, the National Center for Preservation, Technology, Training, which is part of the National Park System, came in with some Hurricane Harvey funds, and they did a workshop on how to repair and reset headstones. And he had called me. I had been in contact with him many times just looking for suggestions. And he called me and said, would you like for us to come down there and do this workshop? And I said, oh, yeah. Oh, yes. This is what I need. And we did a three-day workshop on resetting and repairing headstones. At that time, we had a very pro historic cemetery director of Parks and Recreation, Jay Ellington. And we said, hey, we want a tripod, aluminum tripod, so we can do this. We've all been trained. And there was three of us that had been trained. And we want to do this. We want to our goal was to reset the dangerous headstones. All of them are in danger. Every single one of them are in danger. But some of them are dangerous. They could fall on top of someone. And you really have to have permission from family to do anything to it. However, if the headstone is dangerous, we could do it. You know, the city doesn't want a liability suit against them or whatever. So once we got our tripod, I set up a couple of work days. My most successful was with the Navy chiefs. Called out to the NAS Corpus Christi, and they put me in contact with the Navy chiefs. And the first thing that they did was we reset those veteran headstones. There were 16 of them. But, you know, you get a bunch of guys out there and they're digging and they're resetting and they're showing off how strong they can be. They got carried away with, hey, is there any others we can do? So between those two work days, we probably did 25 or 30 headstones. And it was just amazing. Then we had a group of contractors, Association of General Contractors. They always want to do a day of giving, and they came out there and they hit probably another, 12. And then the Boy Scouts came out there two times and we did probably another 15. So yeah, we've done quite a bit. COVID has, we were planning on doing one last spring, but COVID put a halt to that. We just didn't think we could get out there and social distance. And then summer hit. It's just too darn hot to do it in the summer. But anyway, that's how I became involved with the upkeep and the preservation and such.
Can you tell us some more about some of the stories you learned while you were working on it?
There's just hundreds of them, just 100 of them, 600 of them to be sure. But let me just kind of share some of them with you. probably my favorite one is this, and I have several favorites, is the story of John Marks Moore. And I shared that when I was out there with y'all that day. John Marks Moore was born in Georgia. And on a plantation, his daddy owned a plantation. His granddaddy had this plantation. And when he was born, he was given a slave, Sam. And Sam's about his same age. They grew up together. They learned to read and write together. Sam was, they were side by side the entire time. So Sam was more like a brother, and the more we know about Sam, the more we think he probably was John Mark's brother, our cousin. Okay, so it's we'll never know that story. That's just me speculating. Anyway, when they're 16 years old, Daddy buys a plantation in Alabama that has ironworks on it, and he sends John Mark's up to, I believe it's Pennsylvania, to learn the business of ironworks. And Sam goes with him, and they're 16 years old. What are you doing at 16? Kind of thing. And they come back, and he goes out there, and he's the one that's in charge of that plantation in Alabama. And of course, Sam's right there in with him. And this is coming from his stepdaughter, from Sam's stepdaughter. John Marks only personally had three slaves. Now when he bought the plantation, he had some slaves with that. When he went over to the plantation in Alabama, his dad, sent some with him. But he had Sam, and he had purchased a man that was, maybe he had four. He had purchased a man who had run away over and over and over again. And the owner, told him, good luck, because I can't keep him here. He's gone. But we know he comes back around. And as soon as that man found out that John Marks was now his owner, he came in and worked for John Marks more. He bought a blind man. And then he bought a wife for Sam. And that was when they were in Corpus Christi. Malvina was the slave of the Britons who owned the Centennial House at the time. And which is kind of interesting, because the Britons are ardent unionist during the Civil War. They leave Corpus Christi, but they own slaves. They own Malvina. Anyway, he buys Malvina so that her and Sam can get married. Okay, that's quite a bit later on. Anyway, so while they're in Alabama, John Marks and Sam are in Alabama. Sam gets into a fight, two different stories. He killed the guy or he injured the guy. But it really didn't matter. So John Marks told Sam, you need to leave. You need to go to Texas and you need to go to Mexico. You will be a free man in Mexico. So John Marks leaves. Sam leaves. And he, while in Texas, he was a freighter that took goods into Mexico, and he then in the 1850s, John Marx comes to Corpus Christi, and he brings with him a dredge boat that he had in Alabama to start dredging a ship channel in Corpus Christi, him and a couple of partners. And Sam shows up in Corpus Christi. I don't know if Sam was here first or if John Marx was here first, but they had been in touch with each other, obviously, to both show up at the same time. And Sam works with him on this dredging and other businesses that John Marx has. The dredging didn't take place until late 1850s. And Civil War interrupts the dredging, and nothing happens with the ship channel until the 1890s. But Sam, with John Marx, joins the Confederate Army here in Corpus Christi to defend, because it is port, and we were shipping salt. They had a salt flats out by the Laguna Madre, and salt is a preservative, very important. So they, he was part of the Confederacy. When the Civil War is over, John Marx tells Sam and them, and of course Sam probably already knew that, about the Emancipation Proclamation prior to the end of the Civil War. And he tells Sam, you take a wagon, go out there, and you tell every slave that's out in the countryside that they are now free. And Sam gets in the back of this wagon, and he has a shotgun across his lap, and they take off. And I don't know who they brought in. I don't know if it was an issue. There weren't plantations in this area. So if there was a slave, it was, you know, someone working side by side, the landowner, you know, kind of thing. And it was, my guess is that they didn't come in. What were they going to do? They had a place to live out there. You know, they weren't living in, if they were living in the shack, the owner was living in a shack too. That was just how pretty much slavery was in Corpus Christi area. You had, slaves that worked in Corpus Christi for businesses, for business owners, or they were worked for a shipping company in Corpus Christi. But it wasn't, you know, the plantation, the cotton and all that. They weren't growing cotton in Corpus Christi in Nueces County at that time. So, you know, those images are out. But that story comes from Malvina's daughter, Anna. And she speaks very highly of John Marx Moore, and she speaks very highly of his wife. When the Civil War is over, his wife and a couple others, they start a school for these freed African American and their kids. And it was actually in the same building as the white kids. One was upstairs, the other was downstairs. I can't remember which one was which. And they were taught trades, you know, a skill. The boys weren't there because the boys were out working, but there were no white boys there either. They were out working, but the little kids, they were there, and they were teaching them how to sew, how to cook, how to do those kinds of things, because that's all that women did. You know, they would teach them how to read and write, but there was really no other skill, you know, that they weren't teaching them to load stuff on a ship. You just have to remember that in 1870, that's just what women did. And that's the skill. But believe me, sewing without a sewing machine, that's a skill. That's, you know, that is, and it's a marketable skill. So anyway, when Anna Moore, Anna, the stepdaughter, she marries, she has two boys, I believe it is. And she sends them to Baltimore to be educated, because John Marx Moore's daughter married I think the guy's name is Conklin, and they moved to Baltimore. And my guess is that those two boys were with them. I would be really interested to know what happened to those boys. That, you know, why, I understand one ended up in California, but I've never chased after that lead. That would be a good one to lead, to chase after. I guess another really good story. I mean, the reason I like the John Marks more is because it's really tells the story of what life was like. It also has these connections all the way through with these of other people that are old baby. Another story that I find just fascinating is the Nolan brothers, Tom and Matt Nolan. And they came with Zachary Taylor's troops in 1845. One was 11 years old and one was 9 years old. And they were buglers and drummer boys for Zachary Taylor's troops. And they go and join, you know, they go into Mexico and with these soldiers, 9 and 11 years old. And I think, what is a 9-year-old and 11-year-old doing today? They're not fighting an army. They hang out with Texas Rangers. And that's they become, after the war, they come back to Texas. They're wranglers for the Texas Rangers, Texas Ranger troops and a company, and eventually become Texas Rangers and eventually end up in Corpus Christi. They go into law enforcement. One's a sheriff, one's a deputy. They're both killed in the line of duty, not at the same time, one before the Civil War and one after the Civil War. But just their whole story of what in the world is a 9 and a, you know, a 11-year-old doing. Another story that I liked is Alexander Hamilton. He's a doctor, Alexander Hamilton. He's from Canada. And during the yellow fever epidemic, Corpus Christi lost all their doctors. They all died. And Alexander Hamilton comes down here and he brings with him a student. And that student's name is Arthur Spahn. Okay. And Hamilton was Spahn's preceptor, his mentor. And of course, Spahn goes on. He leaves Corpus Christi eventually, but Alexander Hamilton, he's here and he's in Old Bayview Cemetery. But he, you know, they worked with everything, you know, yellow fever, and because it resurrects itself over and over, it just doesn't go through that epidemic portion. He's down there. The last person that was buried at Old Bayview Cemetery is Perry Boone. And I came across him by accident. It was a newspaper article that I came across at the Collar Times. And Perry Boone was 104 years old when he died in Corpus Christi, and I think it's 1989. And his mom and dad had been slaves. And they have markers at Old Bayview Cemetery. And Perry Boone, he was at one time a deputy with the sheriff's department. And I understand that that's pretty common, that you would have, you know, you would do part-time deputy type of thing, just depending on what's happening in society at the time. But that was in the 1920s or so. Yeah, it'd have to be, because he'd have to be a pretty young man then. And but he becomes a longshoreman. He is one of the founders of the Negro Longshoreman Union here in Nueces County, which eventually merges with the AFL-CIO. And then he was the first person to grab the first line off of the first ship that came into the port of Corpus Christi in 1926 when it opened. Okay. When he dies, he's wants to be buried in Old Bayview Cemetery prior to his death. And the Parks and Recreation said, no, you can't do that. It's closed. Only if you can prove that you have family there. And he said, well, my mom and dad said they bought me a plot. Of course, there's no record of it, but they're there. And after getting some newspaper attention, publicity, the city decided, yeah, let's do that. Let's go ahead and let him be buried there. And we thought he would be right next to his mom and dad. But when we did the ground penetrating radar, he's not there. At least there's no detection of him. And my guess is I called Maxwell Funeral Home because they're the ones that did it. And they said, yes, he is there, but they don't have the location. That would go with the records of Old Bayview Cemetery, which there are no records of Old Bayview Cemetery. Our Parks and Recreation would be the one that was in charge of that, and they don't have anything. So he's there. We don't know where, but he's there. That's, you know, four of them. I mean, I could go on for hours, but we, you know, you just have to come down there and walk it and see it. It's just, there's just too much to tell as far as individual stories. And my battery is at 15%. So I don't know how much longer. I could probably do another question.
Let's take a break. Let's stop the recording and have you pause it.
Okay. Well, you're going to pause it, right? Because you're recording, right?
Yeah, I'm going to stop recording now.
Okay.